On the yellow sheet corresponding to your name, your department, your email. And if you're registered, so put an R. And if you're graduate or undergraduate, put a G for you. So we have an idea of who's in here. Right to read, if it was right in a legal way, it's all clear and evident. As we use this to, can I check who's in draft B? You see that in the picture, put her name at the end, and then we'll...
Okay, let's get started. So today we're going to quickly go through the possible to generalize quantum mechanics. Actually, first we're going to motivate them, explain why they arise, and then we'll quickly state them. Then go on to discuss issues surrounding sequential measurement and maybe some basic principles of what it means to interpret a theory. So we're starting with the discussion of generalized states. So we mentioned last week the possibility of getting non-pure or mixed quantum states by purely classical ignorance. So first we're going to consider classical. Classical indeterminacy figures. So in the case of states, we imagine a device an imperfect device that yields some desired state. We call it psi 1. With probability P 1 and a different state psi 2. With probability P2 equal to 1 minus P1. Then the way we describe that state is by a convex linear combination of the pure states. Convex means that the coefficients are greater than zero. They're really greater than zero. Then we have, so we're assuming. Side one, element of the Hilbert space. Side two is another element of the Hilbert space, such that side one, side two have a non-zero overlap. And if they're normalized. Use the trace row as equal to 1, that's trivial to show, and the row so defined is non-negative. And therefore, permission, however, trace of row squared is less than or equal to 1, strictly less than 1, on the assumption that psi 1 and psi 2 are orthogonal. In fact, the equality is satisfied only if p is equal to 0 or 1. And notice that for finite dimensional Hilbert space, we also have the following bound on trace row squared, which is sometimes called the purity index, because it ends up being a quantitative measure of how pure the state is. So rho is a general state operator sometimes called a mixed state or a non-pure state or sometimes referred to as a density matrix, referring only to some representation as a matrix. So I mentioned last time the ambiguity of mixtures, so I won't go through that again, but the fact that we have some decomposition, some convex decomposition over pure states, doesn't mean that's a unique convex decomposition. In fact, there are infinitely many of them. So it's problematic to understand the state as just being some classical mixture of two states once one identifies such a convex decomposition. By the way, it's worth noting that one can define a maximally mixed state. By the condition rho is equal to the identity operator divided by the dimension. So this represents a situation of total ignorance about the preparation. And last but not least, one can think of these convex combinations in a continuous sense. So one can have some parameter alpha and some continuous probability distribution and some continuously defined set of states. I'm just getting that out of my way. So that should summarize the most practical things you need to know about mixed states. There's one more thing which I will mention shortly when we go to section B, which is that mixed states or non-pure states can arise not just from classical ignorance, but also from tracing over environmental degrees of freedom, and we'll get to that in a moment. So next we'll consider transformations. So consider a non-ideal imperfect device implementing usually some desired transformation, which is the thing with probability p1, a unitary transformation u1, and with probability (1-p1) implementing some transformation u2 is not equal to u1. Strictly speaking, we should introduce some inner product here and say it's non-zero. Then we can represent such a transformation with a map, with a linear map, which is a convex combination again of the two transformations. So this is not a unitary transformation. It is, however, positive, which means that it takes state operators to state operators. So it takes non-negative operators to non-negative operators. So let's define the final state, the density operator rho f. And what you find that in general, trace rho f squared less than or equal to trace rho squared. Okay, no index involved. This is the initial phase. Consistency of notation here. So what that means is it increases the mixedness or the non-purity of the density operator, where, again, the equality is saturated. If either u2 is equal to u1, or if p1 is 0 or 1. So unitary transformations preserve the purity of the system, whatever that purity value is. And convex combinations of unitaries increase the purity of the state. So we can also have continuous decompositions as before. I think there's some parameter alpha, could be like some classical control field, like a magnetic field that's rotating the spins, and you have each time you do the experiment on a different spin, for example, different rotation, you get a slightly different rotation angle due to your imperfect control of the magnetic field. And then you have in the case of an infinite ensemble, we have this continuous density of possibility. So again, this is not the only way to generate these non-unitary transformations. They also arise from tracing over another quantum system, which we'll turn to later in the class. Any questions about this? For how many students is this familiar? Yes, good share.
myself, and you'll have student level.
Sir, is it known sub I or is it need a?
This is sub I, this is means initial. And F means final. So it's evolving under the transformation. And now in the case of, so this is transformations. That was states, and then now we get to measurements. Again, this is from classical ignorance only. So here, generalized measurements. So here now we consider a measurement device. I should do this first. Okay, let me not get to that before I describe something else. So in the previous week we saw that we talked about measurements as being Hermitian operators. And we noted that a Hermitian operator has a spectral decomposition. What I'd like to convince you of is that the fundamental objects here are these projectors and not the Hermitian operator. And the reason for that is that suppose your advisor tells you to go to the lab and measure the operator O. And what you do is you prepare for some state rho. Now what you do is you prepare the state rho, and you know that the probability of outcome k is equal to trace of rho lambda k. Let's call that pk. And then what you do is you do the experiment a bunch of times, and pk is equal to the relative frequency which is equal to the number of outcomes with the outcome k divided by the total number of tests or experiments. So this is an estimator of pk, if you're square root of n factor, depending on the statistics. Now, if you record the pk's, and then you want to calculate O, what you do is you say, well, then O, trace of the operator, Hermitian operator rho in the state rho, is equal to the sum over k lambda k pk. And then you can report this result as the expectation value of O to your advisor. Now what if he changes his mind the next, he or she changes their mind and says, well, actually, really, we should have measured O squared. Well, then, if you've thrown away this data, then you don't know what O squared is based on measurements of O. But if you retain the pk's, which are just the trace of the state times the projector, then this is the fundamental information. And all you do is just go to your do a classical calculation, and you know if the O squared is equal to sum over k lambda k squared times lambda k. And so to calculate the average of O squared, this is just, so then the average of O squared, sorry, this is the trace now, I forgot the trace. So this is equal to the sum over k
I'm glad in the case where Todd is a PK.
So the PKs are actually the things you get out of the experiment, and they're somehow the fundamental objects that are measured empirically. And then the linear combinations you make out of them after the fact is just a kind of a sidebar issue. And in general, as I mentioned in that lecture, I'll just repeat the point that any function of O, because of this generalized spectral decomposition, can be expressed as sum over k, f of lambda k, times the projector onto lambda k. And so let me just summarize some of the language. So I'm calling pk the projector. So it does it literally takes the state and looks at the component of the state, projects onto the geometrically projects onto the component represented by the vector lambda k. And it's a projector is defined by the condition that pk squared is equal to pk, which you can verify trivially. Projectors need not be rank one.
And is that a capital P?
Yeah, this also should have an index.
The other P's.
Yeah. So it's an operator. It's a Hermitian operator. And it satisfies this condition. That's what defines it to be a projector. In fact, non-rank one projectors typically arise when considering observables that have a degenerate spectrum. So there's several eigenvalues with the same numerical value. So with that aside, the point is that from the point of view of standard quantum mechanics, the set of projectors, pk, are the fundamental quantities. And this is called, in shorthand notation, a PDF, which stands for, which means a projector valued measure. And they were introduced by von Neumann. Okay, so now that we've established the projector value measure as the fundamental quantity, and an actual operator is a derivative concept, I can define what I mean by a generalized measurement in these terms. So we consider a measurement which device which implements a projector value measure of, find my notation here. Phi I, but here the I's label the different projectors. With probability P1. And the PDM psi I with probability 1 minus p. One more key property of projectors, which is that pk, so they're orthogonal. Does that make sense? Well.
No,
it's better before. Oh. Project. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. I think that was Raphael, though. He doesn't get a grade. So what do we have when we do this, when we combine these elements? Then we define a set. EI equal to P times phi I plus 1 minus P times psi. So let me justify this. So the point here
in terms of operationally what's happening, is that you measure an outcome PI, the probability of measuring outcome I is given by P1 times the trace, given the state rho as usual, phi I, plus 1 minus P1 times the trace of the same preparation, the same state, times the ket. So the classical ignorance idea here is that you don't know whether it was phi I or psi I that was implemented, but you know that it was the element indexed by I, some value of I. And you don't know if, so one can have a set, this could be 0, 1, this could be 0, so, well, never mind that. But. So the idea here is that one doesn't know which of the projectors was implemented, but you know it was the ith one from the set. And then we can just recast this as trace of rho times P1 phi I plus 1 minus P1 psi I. We'll make these square brackets. And so then we've identified this element, I'll just call it EI. Yes?
Am I mistaken? Is there a positive value tension to it? I thought that the P was the positive.
That's coming right up.
Yeah.
So, if you wait 2 minutes, we'll have your answer. So, what do we notice about the EIs? Well, we know, we can deduce easily that they satisfy the condition that follows from the way it's been defined, which means that these are positive operators. And indeed, this condition is necessary because we want to interpret the P sub I here as a probability, which is a non-negative number. So not only want to be non-negative, we also want the probability to sum to 1, which implies that we require the EIs sum to identity. In fact, well. So we've determined our properties of the set. In fact, these are the complete properties. Which is that one has to have the set EI has to sum to identity, and they have to be positive. Notice that the and we call these therefore positive operator value measures. So as before, we can also obtain positive operator value measures, again, by implementing some PVM on the larger system, two coupled quantum systems, and then tracing out the second degree of freedom, and then we obtain something which is not a PVM, but a positive operator value measure. So if you have some set and you want to check if it's a POVM or a PVM, the key conditions are for a general POVM, EI squared is not equal to EI, which is true for PVM. PVMs arise as a special case. So it's a generalized concept. It includes PVMs as a special case.
Is it the difference that for a PVM we know exactly what measurement we're taking, and for the positive operator one, it looks like we don't know exactly what measurement we're making?
Yeah, we don't know exactly what measurement we're making as a result of classical ignorance here.
Okay.
But you also get POVMs that result from not knowing what measurement was implemented because it's implemented over a larger system, and part of the system you don't have access to.
Okay.
So I'll define what I mean by that in a moment. So I just wanted to introduce thoroughly the idea of how these generalized objects arise from classical ignorance, first of all, because it's conceptually very clear, and secondly, because we don't have time in this introductory 3 weeks to go through deriving what these operators look like by tracing over other systems. We'll do that for the case of density operators, but not for the POVMs and the completely positive maps, which I'll define in a moment, which I've lost track of, actually. Oh, I didn't do that, didn't I? Oh, I did transformations, so you see here. So before I turn to this of the tensor product structure of Hilbert space and the consequences of it, let me just go through some observations about matrix representations. So this is very elementary, and you should all know this, so I'll just review it for simplicity. I mean, for completeness, an operator O, you have a matrix representation. Here I'm just going to worry about finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So basically, given some basis, phi I, we can write down the matrix representation of the operator O in the basis by calculating matrix elements by I, O, by J. We just talk about this O, I, J, where now O represents a matrix element, so it's a complex scalar, and I is equal to the row number, and J is equal to the column number. And we can talk about the trace of an operator O, which is equal to the sum over I, phi I, O, phi I. This is for any operator. It doesn't have to be Hermitian. It can be a state operator or an observable. And then, so now we're going to define an assignment problem. Which is, take some basis 0, 1 of a two-level system. I'm going to assume there's some state psi equals alpha 0 plus beta 1. This is called a coherent superposition. And next, on Thursday's lecture, we'll get into all the fantastic problems this introduces conceptually, but we want to be exactly clear on what a coherent superposition is and when it loses coherence. So now we can express the state operator rho psi psi. So the first problem is express rho equals psi psi in basis 0, 1. So express it as a density matrix. Then I want to consider the mixture or the mixed state rows of M, I'll call it, which is equal to alpha squared 0 plus beta squared 1, 1, and express this in the basis in the same basis. I'm going to continue the problem here. Now I want you to define a basis plus basis equal to 0 plus 1, and the minus equal to 0 minus 1.
the basis consists of plus and the minus it. Let me call this rho set of P. And now express both rho sub P and rho sub M in this basis. And then as a final point, determine a condition on alpha and beta so that rho m is diagonal in every basis. This should be a fairly simple exercise, just as a warm-up. Now we discuss before turning to our final statements of the generalized postulates of quantum mechanics, we're going to introduce the tensor product structure. This is for dealing with composite systems. So the physical concept is composite systems. And the mathematical representation of that is going to be a tensor product structure. Okay, so we have two systems. SA and SB, and we have a total system . This is just an abstract notation. I don't know if the plus sign is the most appropriate way to express that. The Hilbert space in total system is the Hilbert space of system A, is the Hilbert space tensor product of the Hilbert space of tensor B, the tensor product of the Hilbert space of system B, and the state of system A is an element of A, and the state of system B is an element of space B. When we have a total state, psi is an element of H. So now we let the phi A comma I be a basis for H A. And phi bi be a basis in the second Hilbert space. Then we can write down the state vector for the total system We can write down the state of A. It's called sum over ai phi I, where phi a sub I is a basis, so we can expand any vector as a linear combination of the basis vectors.
Similarly for psi b, I'm going to write this down just to define the notation. Grab my a subscript here. My b subscript there. Where ai equals a phi ai interproduct with psi a. And b sub j, this equals a phi b sub j interproduct with psi b. And the general state, psi, the total system state, can be expressed as a sum over ij, cij, phi ai, phi b, comma j. So what this tells us is that these elements form a basis for A. So all possible tensor products of the basis elements in the pairs form the basis for the total Hilbert space. I'm going to erase for a moment.
Do you not want to factor through 1 over root 2 in the plus or minus basis?
Probably do. Yeah.
So it's still
normalized?
Yeah.
Thank you. Actually, you will write up these problems and hand it out as well.
In the community superposition, you imply that A squared plus B squared is equal to 1.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, that's a condition for normalization.
I need to sheet of paper.
Okay, so then if we can also take tensor products of operators, and their action would be defined. We've written down the representation of psi over its basis, decomposition of psi in terms of its basis. We have operator A acts only on the phi sub A eigenstates, and the factor B acts only on the B eigenstates. So again, this is stuff you should all know. I'm just going through it again for completeness. And then in general, any operator O acting on H can be expressed as some linear combination of operators, of products of operators acting on each of the sensor product spaces. And now we're going to define how we get reduced density matrices. So now suppose we have some state psi on this total system, and we have some operator O, which we're defining as A tensor identity. So it only acts non-trivially on the first space. Then the expectation of O is equal to the trace of A times psi, assuming we have a pure state, well, yeah, as we've defined. And what we're going to do is we're going to define an object rho A by the condition trace over system B of psi psi. So that this trace is equal to rho A. This is an operator, and strictly speaking, I'm not sure what the right notation is here, but this trace should be understood only acting over system A, because that's both of these operators act only on the tilde space A. So this is kind of implicit. That's only a trace over A. So how do we calculate a partial trace? Well, the way we calculate it is just like I showed, the full trace, we sum over the expectation value of the operator over the basis. Here we do that, but only for one half the basis, so to speak. So the partial trace over B of psi psi is equal to a sum over J of phi B comma J, where this is actually any basis, by the way. And you can expand psi in terms of the basis elements, as I did here, and get a more explicit formula. I'll leave that as an exercise. The important point is that the trace so defined gives us a density operator, which what it produces. In fact, you can also prove that it's unique, but I haven't looked at that proof. But I'll just state it. It uniquely produces a state operator, a generalized state operator, consistent with this requirement, that you get the same expectation value for any operator O, whether you do it in the full Hilbert space, or just use the partial or reduced density operator in the partial Hilbert space, the factor space. So now, when is this a non-trivial operation? Well, that's intimately tied with the question of entanglement, which we'll define now. Okay, if we get through this quickly, we should have time to discuss some of these issues about state reduction. So we say that the title here. So a pure state is entangled, also called factorable, separable, which is more the generalized concept, and the initial state's not pure, if and only if can be expressed as psi equals psi A tensor psi B. So inspection shows this is a special case of this more generalized decomposition where you can have many coefficients here that are not zero.
Shouldn't that be height angle?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Phi hat cannot be expressed. So it's entangled if and only if it cannot.
Yeah.
I guess it's better the other way. So that's a definition. So now you can exhaustively look for such a decomposition. But when the overall state is pure, there's a simple test for entanglement, a simple criterion. The situation is not so simple when the overall state is not pure. But in the special case of a pure state, we know that a state is psi is not entangled. If and only if trace of rho a squared is equal to 1. So if the partial state or factor state is pure. Now I have another exercise. And this one is it's an assignment problem. And there, what I want you to do is use the Schmidt decomposition, which I'll define presently. The purity of the reduced density operators are equal if the overall state is pure. So now let me define the Schmidt decomposition. Move that up. Yeah, to be expressed as a vector, the state has to be pure. All right, so I'll just quickly define the Schmidt decomposition so you can actually solve this problem easily. The idea basically that for every psi
element of HA, tensor HB.
There exists bases for HA and HB respectively. Such that psi is equal to sum over I alpha I times phi A I tensor phi B I, where the alpha I are non-negative. And of course, by normalization, sum of I. And then we know that, so this is what you need to solve that problem trivially. And then the Schmidt basis is very interesting because we know that psi is entangled if and only if, the Schmidt number NS, which is equal to the number of AI that are strictly greater than zero, is greater than one.
Actually, the parentheses is error.
Okay, good. I have a longer exercise. It should probably be the last exercise for the first problem set. But I think what I'll do is I'll just hand it out rather than go through class. Yeah?
HB, does it have the same matter?
It does not.
Do you have the same index? The two bits?
I think the index is given by the smaller dimension of the two. So it's bounded by the smallest dimension. Alpha is real. All right, so I'll just hand out the exercise. I'm going to go through it after class.
For this, is there a case problem that it's this kind of decomposition? Like, is there a unique, say, expression? The sequences of this out.
I'm not that familiar with it. I think that if the alpha I's can be degenerate, in which case you can have the same numerical value. In which case there's probably some freedom in choosing and defining the basis elements. In fact, that must be the case, because in maximally mixed state all the alphas are the same and you have freedom in choosing the basis. Yes?
How can you actually ever know whether a state is pure or mixed?
You mean how do you test that experimentally?
Yeah, because it's all in the face that you can't see anyways.
No, you can see. You just need to do alternate incompatible experiments on different elements of the not solid of systems prepared in the same way. So in other words, I prepare a state in the bases 0 and 1, and then I do a bunch of tests to prepare the state over and over again, and each time I measure in the Z basis, the 0, 1 basis, and that gives me the populations in the 0, 1 basis. And then I do the same preparation, but now instead measure in the plus minus basis that I defined for that problem, and collect the statistics of the probabilities in the plus minus basis, and then from that you can deduce whether or not the system is pure or mixed, whether the preparation. But you're right that in your individual system, if I just have a single system and I'm allowed to do a single test on it, then all bets are off. There's no way to determine.
Like, is it just like plus 10 and just exactly that question?
So,
you get part of the answer now.
No.
All right, so I'll go through that exercise later. So now what you find then is, where did I mention this? But basically, right, so the partial trace on states gives us a reduced density operator. And if the state space, if the overall state is entangled, then we do quite generically trace of rho a squared will be less than 1. So there's a vast number of states, in fact, almost all states by some arguments and measure theory, will be entangled and will have trace rho squared less than 1. So this is, notice that there's no classical ignorance here. We had a pure state on the system A tensor B, and we only have ignorance about the quantum degrees of freedom, but because of the correlations between the two systems, our knowledge of system A alone is imperfect. So that's a very important feature of quantum mechanics, and it's another way to get generalized state operators, even though one has ideal information about how a system is coupled to another system. And this is critical for our analysis of the measurement problem. So please review your notes on that when we get to the measurement problem by Thursday. So let me just state without demonstration. Lost track of where I am here, so I guess I can go here. So let me just state without demonstration. My analogy we obtain transformations that are not unitary by probably people say tracing out the action of a unitary operator acting on HA tensor HB. So we have some unitary acting on states. The elements of, also mixed states, the elements of A tensor B. And then, so we know exactly what the transformation is on the full system. But when we describe the effective transformation on a subsystem, these are systems in A, we find that the transformation is not unitary. And similarly, we obtain PUVM, positive operator value measures, on HA by tracing out the kind of component of a PVM acting on PVM on HA tensor HB. So the PVM is acting on A tensor B, and the component is only acting on HA. Sorry, we trace out the component acting on HB. Okay, this, my choice of words here is poor. Leaving a POVM on HA. That could have been worded much more clearly. But just for completeness then, I will now state in a formal way kind of our best known summary of quantum generalized quantum mechanics with three postulates. And immediately after this, we'll discuss the differential measurements.
Okay, so for generalized postulates, so, and I'm going to state this in the least kind of the most operational possible language. So the most general description of a configuration, of a systems configuration, in fact, this isn't the most general operational language, it's just quasi-operational. Is given by non-negative unit trace state operator rep. Rank one projectors. Our states maximal knowledge. Every measurement can be described by set EK positive operators. Such that they sum to identity. And here I have to mention the probability of outcome K. Outcome labeled by K for state row trace for row K. And then as a corollary to this, rank one projector value measures correspond to maximal tests. The most general description
a transformation. Completely positive linear map. Which takes a set of positive operators to itself. There are some nuances here to do with whether or not we allow completely positive maps to represent measurements as well, which I'm not going to go into. I'll talk about sequential measurements just in the context of PVMs because it's a lot simpler. Let me just note something I didn't mention to you before. I defined a positive linear map before as something that takes positive operators to positive operators. A completely positive map is one that takes an operator tensor identity of some auxiliary system to another operator, let's call this A and this B, that is non-negative. Actually, I'm a little bit confused by the terminology because state operators are supposed to be non-negative. And positive operators are defined by their action on states, which takes really should take non-negative operators to non-negative operators, but for some reason people say positive. So if anybody has 2 cents to add about what the origin of that terminology is. But this condition is necessary to identify physically allowed maps, this complete positivity. For more details, see, I guess, Nielsen and Chuang is probably the best reference. This is in your list of references. Counterexample is the partial transpose operation, which is positive but not completely positive. And there's a bunch of interesting stuff there about how basically any completely positive map can be represented as a unitary operator on a larger space. It's interesting that some completely positive maps cannot be represented by classical ignorance alone. So let me just make a few general observations. So this summarizes the postulate. Let me make a few general observations. Any mixed state can be expressed by classical ignorance over a mixture of pure states. In fact, that mixture is non-unique. However, a transformation, the most general allowed transformation, cannot always be expressed as a classical mixture over unitary operators on the system space alone. There is a class of maps which require the notion of an auxiliary quantum system that's being traced out to obtain it. And the situation with POVMs, I think, is clear, but it's not clear to me. From talking with some of my colleagues here, it seems that there are POVMs which cannot be expressed merely as a classical mixture of PVMs on the system Hilbert space alone, that always one, for some, POVMs one requires the extended Hilbert space and tracing over it to achieve it. Okay, so next we'll start discussing some dicey issues. And in particular, we're going to start with sequential measurements. But before I do that, are there any questions about postulates? Generalized postulates, yeah?
So first, the consensus, I mean, positive sometimes is used to mean negative. For example, when you talk about a positive matrix and positive operator, right? Sometimes you say positive definite, positive semi-definite. So,
it's positive semi-definite.
If you just say positive unqualified, it can mean positive semi-definite.
Oh, I see.
So that clarifies the terminology. The other question, I don't know if it comes to this, but I mean, in those axioms, there's nothing to tell you corresponding to what people call the reduction.
Yeah, I mean, let's do that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear to me the extent to which, I mean, if we allow these to be trace decreasing, then we've allowed for maps which involve a Virginia collapse. But I guess I'm not.
Something where you have directing too, the results of the measurement. It doesn't tell you what happened to state.
Yes.
After the
it's true.
Under consequences of the measurement.
But you'll notice that we also don't say how to prepare the state, how to prepare some state row. That's kind of left out of the picture, which, so in some sense, the answer to the question of what happens to the state after measurement is the same as the question of how to prepare a state with some specification. And so I guess I shouldn't pretend that you can give these three principles to some person without access to a lab and auxiliary assumptions, and they can reproduce every possible experimental result. I wouldn't claim that this is the complete information required to describe all experiments, but it's close to it. But as Rafael pointed out, one of the missing ingredients, which may or may not be implied by these postulates, is how do we deal with the state after measurement? How do we deal with sequential measurements? So the initial discussion of sequential measurements was probably due to Heisenberg, where he was considering non-commuting measurements that are simultaneous or sequential in some sense. And there he observed through qualitative arguments that you couldn't determine both the values of complementary variables with perfect accuracy for a single system, which we noted was distinct from the indeterminacy principle. So now, what about in the case of, say, just commuting operators? So von Neumann considered the Compton experiment, which was pivotal in establishing the particle nature of electromagnetic radiation. So there, the idea was we have a collision between a photon and an electron, and then they're both scattered off. And we can measure the angles. And what Compton showed is that we can treat the collision as a particle collision. When we treat the electromagnetic radiation as a particle with energy E equals h nu and momentum P equals E over C, equals H over lambda, and that we can adequately describe the outcomes in this angular shift, the angular dependence in the shift of the frequency of the emitted photon, which is due to, just like in a standard elastic collision, it's loss of energy because it gives kinetic energy to the electron in the initial rest frame of the electron. So we called in, von Neumann considered a different aspect of this experiment, which was to consider three possibilities in decreasing levels of randomness. One is that the properties, the momentum, he noticed that the electron, this is a measurement device, and the photon were collected at subsequent times. So there was some finite time delta t between interception of E and the photon. And so he said, well, there's three possibilities. One is that the momentum of the observed electron has a dispersion, and there's some randomness in what particular value we observe. And the momentum of the photon has some dispersion, has an uncorrelated dispersion, I should say. This is analogous to by one. An uncorrelated dispersion.
The second is that the momentum of the electron has a dispersion. We'll call this 1A, 1B. 1A holds, but 1B does not hold because the momentum of the photon is fixed and correlated with the electron. And the third possibility is that both are predictable a priori. Both particles momenta can be predicted with certainty. Or maybe prediction isn't the key point, but rather that the outcomes are certain given the same preparation. There's no dispersion. So whether or not you can predict them is irrelevant. The fact that empirically you find there's no dispersion is probably the key point. So he's showing
the fact that that's impossible.
Well, when we're constructing a theory, anything's possible. But the question is very vague in conservation of energy and momentum. And he pointed out that all three were logically possible, but experimentally, he found this result. That so this is what was observed. But as you pointed out, it is true that this is demanded if we assume the conservation of energy and momentum, which in fact is observed, and is an important principle in physics. But what's interesting is that we can't predict the distribution of momentum with certainty because of arguments similar to Heisenberg's microscope. But what we do find is that the momentum of the photon, which is an operator that commutes with the momentum of the electron, it's determined. And it has to be correlated. It exhibits a dispersion, but a dispersion that's correlated with the dispersion of the momentum. So given a specific outcome of the electron, then we can actually predict what the outcome of the photon will be. So it still exhibits a dispersion because the electron momenta are distributed, but that at each point is by something fixed, I should say correlated here. So given your knowledge of the electron's momentum, I probably get it backwards actually, because I think you intercept the photon first. But anyways, it's immaterial for the discussion. The point is that there's a small delta t during which you can actually predict without having observed what the momentum will be. So this was the basis for, this was von Neumann's operational and empirically motivated reason for introducing the collapse postulate. I wanted to make that clear because in some of the reading I've done in the past, I was left with the impression that the collapse postulate was introduced in an ad hoc way to deal with ambiguities that arise because of the Schrodinger's cat paradox, which we'll discuss. But that's not at all the case. The projection postulate was there, and it conveniently dealt with, well, at least in some people's minds, the issues that were raised by Schrodinger's paradox. So let me just summarize then von Neumann's understanding of transformations. So this is just in the case of idealized quantum mechanics. So he thought this was so important, this aspect of quantum mechanics, that he called it the first rule. It was the first rule of transformation. And it's that, tells us David's after there. Well, I don't have his exact wording, so let me just, that,
of some outcome. Remember, he's considering Hermitian operators. We call this process one. And the second law of transformation is normal Schrodinger evolution. Maybe I'll wrap up there, but I'll formalize the actual mathematical equation here. This is process two on Thursday. But this is assuming that you have some operator O with spectral decomposition, sum over K, and then the K. So it's measuring the Hermitian operator, and the probability of outcome K is the trace of O rho. And so process one means that rho goes to lambda K. And he points out this is what he called an essential randomness. In nature. And he refers to this as acausal. Because while the sequence of states determined by Schrodinger evolution is fully determined by unitary transformation, acausal, the outcome lambda k that occurs is random. There's no way to predict it. It's just observed. And so this led to discussions which we'll turn to over the next three lectures of quantum mechanics having an intrinsic randomness, an intrinsic indeterminism on this view. And then there's another issue about when is it appropriate to use the process one versus process two to describe a transformation. And there, there's a lot to be said about that. And so we'll go into those details. I guess what I'll do is I'll just type this up in LaTeX and put it on a web page. I guess we're not on the web page, I'll put it later. So next week will be a web page, by Thursday. So we have one more assignment problem to cover, maybe a couple more. The first assignment. With that, thank you for your attention. I think that was a couple.